I'm Fraser T. Smith, a music artist, record producer, musician and songwriter, and I've made an album called 12 Questions under the name Future Utopia. Each track on the record poses a deep philosophical question, and I've invited some of the sharpest minds in popular culture to answer these questions in order to help me and others navigate living in the modern world. In this episode, I welcome two award-winning luminaries, Kay Tempest, the spoken word performer, recording artist, novelist and playwright, and George the Poet, the remarkable spoken word performer and social commentator. So on this episode of the 12 Questions podcast, I am absolutely thrilled to have Kay Tempest and George the Poet, two legends in culture and society. I am in awe of you both, from a musical adoration to your social commentary, to your activism, your writing, your poetry, your performance. You not only push culture forwards, but you push society forwards with your wisdom, your ability to translate your ideals into words that have this huge impact through whichever medium you choose. And the fact that you work across genre and across mediums is just so incredible to me. So I make a point on these podcasts of keeping this warm, because these are my words, not Google's words. You know, we can Google you both and check all your awards and all your accolades, but for me, I'm just in awe to have you both on this podcast and to hear your answers to some of these 12 questions. Welcome, George and Kay.
Thanks for having me.
Shall we kick off then with question one, George? Fear or faith?
Faith for me. Definitely faith. Like, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I think fear is underrated. We often talk about fear in a negative way, but there's a reason our ancestors developed that response, isn't it? It not only helps you focus on, like, helps you identify a way forward, but it also pushes you. It's the wind in your sails a lot of the time. But for me, trying to envision things that I can't necessarily confirm or provide evidence of, that's the faith. That's what's led to the biggest breakthroughs in my life. So I think you've got to have a healthy balance of both, but I try and fall on the side of faith.
That's really interesting. Kay, are you which side, or are you in the middle?
No, I am fully on the side of faith. Without faith, for me, there would have been no propulsion and no, I don't know. It's like, the thing is that if you are motivated by fear, then what you're going after will never be enough. And the goals that you are hoping to attain will never satisfy you. But if you're motivated by a true faith, and whether that is a religious faith, a spiritual faith, or just a faith in the desire itself, you know, then the possibility of service, of satisfaction, of humility is opened up. That as a culture, we live in a culture of fear. Like, the idea of consumption, endless consumption, or attainment of accessories in order to have some kind of status, this is all about fear. And not being good enough compared to your fellows makes you suspicious of others. And this is all about, it means that if you make a decision based on faith, on desire, on a reason for wanting to get something or get through something or give something, that is a choice. Then the possibilities for that choice to be healthy are just so much more vast. Whereas I think if you can even become aware of how much the fear mentality of our culture can infiltrate your quietest, most private moments. It's, for me, that's the game at the minute. It's like trying to check in with how much of this poisonous culture is inside my most intimate decision making. And so for me, it's always faith, and faith brings me back to myself when I've strayed.
Is it?
Yeah.
Could we say that fear is a in the larger sense, a man-made construct then?
I think there are things that humanity does to itself, and society does to itself, that can feed into fear, but I don't know. I wouldn't personally go that far. I would say there's a reason. I think fear comes from mortality. You know, the ultimate thing that we can't control. The clock's ticking. You know, the ones that everyone's got a cutoff point. So that we know that there's things that we can't control. And we know that sometimes things that slip out of our control cause grief, cause a lot of pain that we have to live with. But from that fundamental understanding, I think society then goes on to place importance on things that are sometimes not important. Things that are completely human made. Things that are completely constructed. Kay just made a great point about looking at your peer group and sometimes these completely arbitrary, artificial markers of progress or success or stability or responsibility. All the things that we look to say, yeah, that's a G, that's a person who's got their stuff together. Sometimes it's fleeting. You know the ones there, but you can't even see it because of the society that, yeah, humans have set up for themselves. I always find one thing that blows my mind, yeah, is that I grew up in the second poorest borough in London, yeah? And the poverty of our environment is often used as the foundational explanation for a lot of the problems that we go through. But then my parents come from one of the poorest countries in the world, Uganda. But these environments, Northwest London, my Northwest London, and my part of Uganda, even though they're known as economically depressed areas or relatively poor areas, they both harbor such life, such magic, magical people, magical experiences. And the outcomes that people get from life in these environments, it's all largely it's about your ability to recognize, you know, the glass is half full. There's no formula for it, you know what I mean?
Amazing answers. Hearing you both talk, you know, I just go back to school, sitting on these podcasts. You know, I learn so much from all the different viewpoints and angles of these questions that are so open-ended. But the way you both described that was just phenomenal.
Can I interject? Just because I've just been thinking this one thing off the back of what George is saying and also off that question. I know we've got to move on to the other questions, but I just think what's interesting to say is like, yes, no, fear is not a man-made. I mean, it's instinctive, it's instinctual. It's something that we developed because we were before we were predators, we were prey. We had to have fear so that we could learn how to band together and flee animals that wanted to eat us. So it's not man-made, but what is man-made or what's encouraged by culture or society or the way that we have chosen or decided or ended up living? If you think about why is fear a useful emotion to cultivate in the population and why is faith not so much of a useful state of mind to cultivate? Because when you're in a fear mentality, you make rash decisions. You're not completely in tune with your own compass. So in the hysteria and the madness and the insanity of late capitalism, then fear is a really healthy thing to foster and create in the population. Because as long as we're living in that fear, then we're being led and guided to make decisions in a very unstable state. That's what I wanted to say.
Fascinating. You touched on filling up the well with faith, and that would probably lead into the next question, how much is enough?
Yeah, I think, I mean, even asking that question, trying to quantify, is a trait of a mindset that means it will never be enough. Even how much is enough means, basically, I would say that even asking that question is suggesting that there is a quantity that is worth obtaining. Whereas actually, if you think about, this might sound completely far-fetched and like, I don't want to sound like, I don't know, like too kind of whimsical about this kind of thing, but I feel like as soon as you take the pressure off yourself to obtain a degree or an amount of anything, and you just exist or allow yourself to exist with what's going on right now, rather than projecting about what you need to obtain or worrying about what you have, what has happened in your past or where you're trying to get to in your future. And if you just can, if I can just allow myself to sit and be present with where I'm at, then there is no enough, too much, not enough. There is, it doesn't exist. What exists instead is something much more beautiful and much more inviting and much more conductive to the creative spirit, which is, for me, it's creativity itself. That's where it is. It's in the
and
present.
That's infinite, right?
Is infinite. Fraser is infinite. It's exactly what I'm saying. So it's a kind of way of backing out of the question. I'm sorry, but...
No, it's not. Yeah. You've answered that wonderfully. I've been doing some mentoring recently with a wonderful young artist called Mizey, and I'm trying to convey this feeling that through your career, and I'd be interested to see whether you both think this is a good metaphor or how I could improve it, but... And this is where I'm trying to be as well, which is in this field of all possibility, which is the creative field, which is the literally the ploughing of the earth and sowing the seeds, but being happy within that process, which is all we really have, then you do reap what you sow. But the thing that most people are trying to attain, which is people coming into the field and picking the fruit and praising you, is just a fleeting byproduct of where we as creatives and artists should really be living, with the soil in our fingernails and on our knees, planting and planting and then refining and going back and planting. Like, is that a good thing to pass on to the younger generation, do you think, or just a weird metaphor I've got wrong and I need to
correct? That if you're mentoring young artists, then it's like that's a wonderful position to be in, and I'm sure that it's valuable for them, like, for sure. Like, it's the metaphor of sowing and reaping is like that's useful for sure. But I think the thing about creativity is, as much as we might talk about it as this beautiful thing, and it's not about people coming in and picking the fruits of the labors, etc. Like, it, for me anyway, I don't know about you guys, like, it does come from a place of conflict. Like, if everything had been peachy in my life and I didn't have to prove myself or want to resolve some of these things that I had inside me that needed resolving, then I wouldn't probably have turned to this. I wouldn't have felt the compulsion, the need, the desire, like, to write, to create myself out of where I was in. So it's like, I think it's probably healthy and worth saying, as much as I might strive for a more peaceful relationship with my creativity, my fellows, whatever, it also, it does, for me, it comes from a place of, like, ego, conflict, a need to prove or speak or dig down into my emotions to try and deal with them. So I agree that it's a cool metaphor to say, look, hey, let's get that. It's about the process. Get down on your knees and let's farm this earth. But at the same time, it's like the shiny things that come off the tree at the end of the thing, like that. It, that has been a motivation when I started out, that, you know, I was looking, that was a goal, and it took me my maturity or my approach towards maturity to understand that wasn't the eventual aim.
Mm. Yeah, that's really powerful way of looking at it. George, do we really care?
In the development of the next, do we care about what in specific, in particular? Oh, the next question, sorry.
In general, in a specific, in whichever way you take that question.
I was deep into the metaphor, the metaphor. Do we really care? This is such a good question. So right now, yeah, this commission got together and released this report about race. And everyone in the news is, or I have different news channels asking me for comment. It's like, that's the question that comes up for me, Fraser. Do we really care? See me, going back to what Kay just said. If it wasn't for growing up in these communities that I just described to you, I don't know if I would have the clarity that I have in terms of what to do with my skill set and my opportunities. I know exactly what to do because I've been thinking about this since I was young. I've been thinking, my mum played my little brother, my big brother and I, a 1970s TV series called Roots documented the transatlantic slave trade. Very brutal. 6 years old, I was like, oh, this happened to black people. All right, cool. And then ever since then, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I have understood that we are the latest chapter in that story. Modern society is the latest chapter in whatever happened of the past. So for that reason, I've gone through all of these different phases of being upset, being angry, blaming us as a group for what has happened to us, blaming my generation for what we are not able to get on top of and just control. And just as I've grown older, again, to what Kay was talking about previously, I've realized that this is part of it, you know, that we have an imperfect world, and we've got histories that all are, you know, punctuated with trauma to an extent, yeah, as humans, as societies. So when this race report came out and the headline was no evidence of structural racism, and you know, half the people in the discussion were upset and half of them felt vindicated and victorious over these whining race baiters, they call us. I just felt like it's just a redundant argument that we're having, because do we really care? Do you really care? Like, are we talking about the same thing? Because when we are talking about the same thing, we will, you know, our conversations become solution oriented. Two people who are not in a relationship together but are interested in the healthy development of their child can have a conversation about the child without having to get into all the things that they don't like about each other. But if the focus isn't, you know, what you really care about, and the focus is just offloading everything negative inside you onto, you know, something external that you can point to and say is the source of your problems or is the bane of your existence. So there is no overall answer to this. And there is no final answer within an individual. You got to ask yourself every single day, which is how I think of, is how I feel the requests, the news requests, when people ask me to come on the news. Even when George Floyd lost his life last year, people were asking me to come on the news. And my first question was like, people that are asking me, the platforms are asking me, do they care? And a lot of the time I felt like, no, they don't. But then that's just one question. Me, I actually care. So if the moment passes without me being able to comment, it's going to bother me on a personal level. And if the moment passes with people who I suspect might care a little less than me taking up the space that I would have taken, that would also bother me. So that informs how I move forward, knowing what I care about and knowing how to communicate my concerns, but also knowing that it's just impossible to fully understand, it's impossible to fully resolve anything that is outside of your control. That's my opinion.
I love that. You take the responsibility of your care. I learned a lot from going to visit Albert Woodfox in New Orleans, who'd, I don't know if you know his story, but he was a Black Panther that was incarcerated for 44 years in a 9x4 feet cell for 23 hours a day.
And was that over the shooting of a cop or killing of a cop?
Yes, within the prison, but it was never proven that it was him or the other members of the Angola 3, which is what they were called. So that makes the story even more poignant. But the only way that he was able to get through was, and he talked about, I know it's very different, this, but still that responsibility of separating what was external to what was internal, and to be able to move outside of the prison walls by controlling his mind, which was possibly the most powerful thing that anyone had ever said to me. We've all sat with great people, but for someone to have lived through that and to have taken that responsibility, and he said to me that he made the decision to become free at around the age of 43, which was about 30 years left to serve. And he didn't know that when he was going to be released, but it was interesting that personal responsibility that just resonated with me when you were talking about that, George. Okay, I'm going to move on to question four. What's in a name?
Well, that's an interesting question. I feel like we take names, new names, at important moments in our lives, like when we have these moments of transition. So, for example, I took the name Tempest as a teenager. It was my rap name. I was about 15, 16. And it was a real moment for me where I kind of inherited the superpower of that name. And it gave me a mode. It was like Tempest mode. It was a name for something that was happening for me naturally. And then it became, as people started to refer to me that way, the name took on more significance. And I feel like, and recently changing my name, coming out as trans non-binary and changing my name to Kay, that was a huge thing for me. That's very, very important thing that I felt I had to shake off some of the shame that I've been carrying my entire life. And I had to be able to face the world with a new name. It was just something I knew I had to do. And to make it a public declaration, that's kind of a strange thing to do. But if I didn't have a public life, I would still have had to make that declaration to my friends and family. But there's this other, I don't know, there's this other level to it because I have this career. But now every single time someone calls me by that name, I feel seen and welcomed, and I feel more myself. And so but if you think about the times in which people take new names after a marriage, for example, or at certain times after religious rites or experiences, people get a new name. You know, it's something about a reclamation or a reclamation of being that says, actually, like, I take matters into my own hand, and rather than being what I'm seen as or what doesn't feel good or what is put upon me, I've obtained a new level, and this is how you can call me now. It's like you're leveling up with experience. You're looking it in the eye and saying, okay, I'll take you on your terms, now please take me on mine, you know. And for me, that's powerful. That's a really powerful thing for a person to be able to do, and especially someone from the community that I'm coming from. You know, names are important, and often having your government name, you know, it can be very, very traumatic for people, for trans people. So for me, there is a lot, and there is so much in a name. There is so much in a name. Also, it's a mark of respect if you allow yourself to communicate with somebody whose name has changed and you knew them before with their different name, and you know, and it can be difficult to remember to call them by their new name. I think it's just, for me, with friends of mine, it's a mark of respect. It's like you can see that I respect your decision, and that I'm here and I'm loving you, and I'm protecting you, and I'm here and I've got your back, and this is how I show it. So yeah, for me, it's a big thing.
It's really powerful and very inspirational that you've evolved. Your name has reflected your evolution through life, and that to me seems incredibly, incredibly powerful.
Thanks. Thanks for giving me the space to talk about it.
George, why are we divided when we're so connected?
Probably because of fear, isn't it? Mm. It, as we grow, you know, our stories about ourselves and about our environment become more and more involved, become more intricate, more complicated. And if I have to wrap my head around how Kate became Kay and what they might teach me about myself that I hadn't had that education anywhere else, and if I have to wrap my head around that from a fearful place, then I might feel like how all of those people who call me a race baiter feel when I talk about Britain or British society. You know, I might feel that in someone else discovering themselves, I am diminished somehow, or someone else establishing themselves, it encroaches on my worldview. You know, if I'm coming from a fearful place. But if I have the expectation, going back to what Kay was saying, because he's a fucking oracle, going back to that thing about, like, expecting that life is infinite and that you have all the time and space that you need to be what you would always become it, then someone else's worldview, someone else's story, unless obviously they're saying that in order for them to survive, I need to go, their perspective doesn't really have to draw me out to the point where, you know, I lose faith in people. That's what happens, isn't it? We lose faith in people. Bear in mind, we're some artists on this thing, and on this podcast. So we're going to sit around and say artsy stuff. It's just who we are. It's fine. But it's, you know, it's real in the field at the same time. You go out there and there are people who really don't like you. Mm-hmm. And there are people who don't like themselves and are not invested in life. And in the environment I come from, there are people who are ready to take life, innit? But I'm also a student of the humanities. I'm a social scientist. And if you really, even if you just reduce society to a science, what you're going to find is the fundamental, you know, the first part of your the second part of your question, we're connected. There are fundamental connections. There are parallels. Even the people that think that you are the antithesis of them, even they can't escape the commonalities that bind us. Mm. So it's like, if people don't get the breathing space, people don't get the breathing space to fully absorb that and honor it, you know, the human connection, the universality of our experience, then yeah, they suffocate themselves or they stifle themselves of the understanding and the empathy that will allow us to live harmoniously, you know what I mean? But it's like, again, going back to what Kay was saying in the beginning, the way our living, the way our lifestyles are organized, you know, late capitalism, the way time is distributed and tied in with money, time is money, and you know, it can be hard to get that space, get that breathing space where we see what we have in common over what we have in difference.
Mm. So much food for thought. Yeah. Mm. Kay, how do we find our truth?
Oh, I'm still buzzing off what George was just saying. I'm like, I feel like that is a really amazing point, and it maybe relates to this question as well. That two things. Well, one thing, that life is traumatic and people are carrying a hell of a lot, and often in that mode, in that fight or flight mode, it's impossible to have love, you know, endless outpouring of love and the time to think and reflect and the time to kind of check in with yourself. And this thing about divisiveness and division, why are we divided? I feel like it's possible to be divided from others only if you're divided from yourself. Like, this is the first frontier, like, for that stuff. And that actually there will be a deep-rooted malnourishment at the core of a person. That this is the thing, the wound that you carry through your life, which either like motivates you to violence or to despair or to addiction or to any act that is against the self, you know. And the secrecy of how we must look like to all the people around us that we're coping, I feel like that forces all of that violence and that poison out. You put it over there on them and it's their fault, and it enables the divisiveness. And actually, also, the algorithmic categorization of personhoods increases this idea that, like, you don't even need to think carefully about what you yourself think, feel or experience, because there's a meme that someone else posted, and actually that expresses what I feel much more succinctly, and it means that I don't even have to think carefully or to reflect or take stock of where I'm at, because actually that's where I'm at. I can see it, and all those other people, that's where they're at too, so that's easier for me to go with that. It's easier. It feels better. It feels nice to exist in a crowd and be a part of something. It's harder to be like truly reflective and take stock of the wound that you carry and where it came from and why you carry it. So the question that you just asked me, which was about truth, can you repeat the question please, Fraser?
Of course. How do we find our truth?
How do we find our truth? Right, so that's what led me to what I was just saying. George made a really good point earlier on as well about the moment that we're in is the result of the entire historical context of how we got here. This is not a new dawn that doesn't exist because of every single other like day that passed before. Like, to cut ourselves off from the historical context is to abandon ourselves completely to futility and fear and not understanding, and nothing is clear, and how did we get here? And actually, it's very clear how we got here. This is the result of something that has had its teeth into us for hundreds of years. And there's been many, many voices that have spoken about where we're heading, you know, look out, and then we're here. And it's like, how do we get here? Well, it's clear. And the truth that I'm talking about is something that exists in all of us, I believe, this feeling of dissatisfaction, despair, disquiet that we dampen down and we fill with whatever it is, ambition that you're living for, whether it's a family or a house or a car or, I don't know, like the desire to travel and see the world or whatever it might be that's keeping you, that's giving you the motor. Like underneath all of that, the thing that that's masking, there is this this commonality, this experience of living that I think every single person knows. This isn't, and I'm talking about here in the West, I'm talking about specifically, you know, the culture of the city in London. There is some kind of divorce from our humanity, our shared sense of like what life should give us or feel like or what it should be for. So like, I just went off on a bad tangent, but my point is that the truth is the historical context. The truth is taking accountability for how you got what you have. The truth is understanding that nobody is wrong about anything. People, they may disagree, but belief is a strange thing because who am I to say that what you feel, what you think, or the conclusions you've drawn are wrong? I'm no one. But I don't know. The conclusions I've come to are informed by a set of experiences that I could narrate as my life. But actually, the truth is that nobody's wrong about any of this shit. And actually, like, having enough love in your heart to extend towards people whose belief systems are against your personhood, even, like, there are people that would like me to not exist, you know, like, and I have to take that and think, yeah, why, of course, like, I have to take that and see that with enough patience that it's like, I know no more about the things that I believe than you know about the things that you believe. We're all in the same mess, like, and then really it comes back to the same thing I was saying earlier about stripping away, stripping away, stripping away. And when you take the heat out of the argument, just like George was saying, like, two adults that have separated, if they're not attacking each other, they can have a conversation about the welfare of a child, like, or the education of a child, or the future of a child. It's a really good metaphor, because if we can take the heat and the blame out of the argument, then we can actually talk about the future, you know, without it being my fault or your fault that we've got, this is where we are, look at where we're at. And what are you talking about, like, you know, like, calling each other names and despising each other's beliefs. Like, actually, there's a bigger thing here. There is a future at stake. And that's the truth, really.
That sounded like a verse.
Blood. Everything she said sounded like a verse. I'm still adjusting.
No problem. It's really nice that you corrected yourself. I appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you.
Respect, man. There was a 40-second run where you kept rhyming here. You said here, yeah, fear, and you just did it purely subconsciously. That thing was mad.
Yeah. Same for you, though. Come on, man.
I'm just sitting here like I'm in a mental health spa. I'm just like, my eyes are shut. And I could just listen to this all day and all night. It's incredible. George, what's the cost of freedom?
Damn, man. Malcolm X said the price of freedom is death. Mm. When I think about that, you know, every couple of weeks, like, is that it? I got him on the wall here, and that was his truth. That was his truth. I would say the price that I'm willing to pay for freedom, yeah, is my life. But not in the sense of ending my life, but the commitment, what I commit my life to. That is what I'll find freedom in. It's very similar to what you said about your panther in Louisiana. Albert what? What was his name?
Woodfox.
Albert Woodfox. It sounds like that's what he was describing at 43 years old. It's like, I can only find freedom in my time here, innit? And if my time here is confined to a box, then I need to find freedom in the box, innit?
Which it was in turn the freedom in his mind.
Exactly, because your mind is infinite. Your experience. When I left my, when I backed away from the music industry a couple of years ago, I had a very practical challenge, which was, what's the format that I'm going to translate myself through? Because I couldn't be like, hey, I couldn't do albums. It wouldn't have worked for me. And I realized that I needed to, I was trying to basically pull together a meta-narrative, a big story about bare things, what, like why my community is the way it is and why it's similar to all the other communities in inner cities where darker skinned people live, lower income. I was trying to, you know, we didn't receive this education in school and our parents weren't necessarily equipped to explain it to us, and especially my parents being immigrants, they didn't really understand this environment. So that was really what was weighing on me. Like, how do I explain it? Because I can see, we see like youth violence, for example. And I know, just like every other black man who grew up in my environment knows, that around 15 years old, the penny drops and you realize that there is no authority in the world who would lay it all on the line for you. You know, that's not exclusive to black people in the inner city, but I think many black individuals, especially in immigrant communities and diasporas, we don't fully belong in the land of our grandparents. We're made to feel like we don't fully belong wherever our parents settled. So there's a displacement there, a deep, deep displacement. And I was trying to articulate that, you know, because I find that to be the foundation of having a serious conversation with a young person who has murderous thoughts. You got to address whatever is missing in a way that they can, you know, in a way that resonates with them. So I was trying to figure that out. Like, how do I do that? How do I tie together that story in a way that people can concentrate and not, like, take me in 3-minute bits and forget what the last thing I said was? And that's how I landed on my podcast. But in order to land on that podcast, the first thing I realized was that instead of trying to tell the big story out there, I got to tell the story in here. Like, who am I? What's going on inside me? And then when I started trying to articulate that, I realized that my thing is infinite. If I try and tell you who I am, we could be here for the rest of my life. And I was liberated by that. And that opened me up to podcasting as a format that I can start to build my exploration. So yeah, definitely. I would say commitment, man. Just commitment is probably the cost of freedom. You gotta commit to, if you try and commit to being honest with yourself, everything else is gonna work itself out around that.
It's so interesting because I can hear that in your podcast, like, George. When I listened to it, I had my hand like I couldn't believe it. My hand was covering my face because I was like, I've never heard anybody do this, even try and do this. It was like a euphoria that I felt because of I could feel the decisions that you'd had to make, like the way you would have had to have thought that whole thing through. I didn't know that you had that you weren't into that, like, making albums wasn't working for you and that you needed some new avenue to express yourself, but I could also feel your commitment to education and to offering perspective and to opening yourself up in order to examine the bigger picture. Like, I could feel all of that, and I was breathtaken by it. I was just like, right, it was like game changer, as you know, as I'm sure people have said to you a lot. It's like, but to just hear someone doing it and doing it with this kind of calm, very self, like, it was like composure. I felt composure in it, and I was like, wow, this is important, really. And so thank you for what you made and for what you continue to make. It's like, I can feel your commitment for sure.
Yo, coming from you, yeah, that resonates differently, because there was an album of yours that I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was between 2015 and 2017. Yeah. Do you remember?
Let Them Eat Chaos.
That one there.
Yeah.
It's that. I should have been said this to you, but that one there did something for me. It was like a license. It was like a license to be like, you know exactly what you're trying to say. You know exactly who you are. And the problem is, you're trying to make it, you're trying to put the audience before your own voice.
Yeah.
You're trying to figure out how to say it in a way that they might like or they might want. When really and truly, this little thought process that you're going through right now, you just need to capture that. So your work played a very big part in me landing on that sort of respect.
That's amazing. I feel bad for the audience listening, being like, oh my gosh, stop it. Like, stop it, guys. Like, come on. Move it along. No, but that's deep. That's really, really deep. I'm so glad to hear that you've had this like little revelation moment. This is amazing. How exciting.
I think the truth in both of your art across everything that you do is that I think is what keeps me going. Because I see that when the path is truthful and when the path is sure like that, that's where things connect.
Do you find, Fraser, do you find that when you're writing for other people, like that you're, the truth of what you put into it or the truth of what you hope to be into it, when someone else has their truth with what you've made, you know, what you've written, how does it land with you? Has it ever been the case that you're like, oh, this person has put a completely new slant on something that I didn't realise was there, or, you know?
Yeah, for sure. But it's an interesting question, Kate, because I think the big difference is that I am, with my collaborators, I'm really aware that it's their record and I'm there to be of service in any way that I can be. So I approach it from that point of view, and that yields good results because I can be flexible and malleable, and I'm there to play the role that I think is most important to help them. But then sometimes you can also feel, in some ways, I'm talking about one song in particular that I found very challenging, because it was a song, Black, that was Dave's song, and I felt that brought up a whole host of emotions for me to be included in that song and to be awarded an incredible award for that. It brought up emotions because it landed, and I think that in making it, I was again just focusing on being as much service as I could to Dave in his pursuit of this incredible song, but then to then be given an award made me, it just brought up quite a lot of negative emotions within me, and took me a while to come to terms with it, if I'm honest. A feeling of being an imposter, and then a feeling of going back to what the three of us have been saying, that you know, we can sit here as artists, and it really brought home to me how music connects, and how loving the art form is, and that then to really see the message of that song and to hear the pain in Dave's words really brought it home to me how imperfect life is outside of the wonderful bubble that we find ourselves in creatively and artistically.
That was a great question and a great answer. Great. I get that one 5 out of 5, guys.
Okay. Yeah. Is it too late to save the planet?
Maybe this is a controversial thing to express, but my feeling is that the planet is okay. The planet is going to be fine. The thing that needs saving is humanity, but really, like, I mean, is it too late to save humanity is a different question, because, you know, it depends what your view is on the nature of humanity itself. But the planet, I believe, will find its way. You know, things, these great huge tectonic shifts that have come and gone in the lifespan of this incredible, beautiful planet that we are lucky enough to have been born on, amongst, with, for, you know, in. I don't feel that like the human story, actually. Although in our minds, we're the most important thing that ever happened to this planet. The reality is that we're not, you know, we're not. And once our time is run out, and the next thing, the next chapter, the next evolution has come and gone, and they're some bored young of that new being learning about human beings, they're gonna be like, we're just gonna be a story that someone tells to someone else at some point. Maybe if we're lucky, then we'll survive as that. But you know,
I love that viewpoint, I really do. And it's actually similar to what Katrin Friedrichs, the abstract artist that I ask that to in the record, she says that the planet can survive without humans, but humans can't survive without the planet. And it was just as simple as that. And that's echoing what you're saying.
Not that that makes me think that we should absolve ourselves from responsibility of trying to make this place habitable and, you know, to take care of it. And obviously to stop like destroying animal life and natural life. Like, I'm not trying to say that we absolve ourselves of that responsibility, but also just, I think there's a kind of degree of like human self-importance that we need to put in check, you know, that we have been fed that myth about progress, about the development of the human, you know, from Neanderthal to Homo sapien. This is a myth, a story that we've been fed because it feeds into late capitalism, which also has its roots in the complexes of exploitation of people and mineral wealth and land mass. All of this has led to the moment that we're in right now, like we talked about. And if we believe in this myth of development of the human being, if we allow ourselves to believe in this, then it goes along with our the myth of dominion, you know, the human dominion over, and it, the fact that we can sell ourselves this story that it's okay to destroy nature in order to preserve humanity. It's all part of a story that we live in that helps us to sustain some sense of purpose or righteousness or sanity. But it's a story. Have you ever sat in the forest? have you ever just sat in the forest? Like, come on. There is communication happening at such an intrinsic and powerful level amongst trees in a forest. And we have so much to learn. I read this amazing book, called The Mushrooms at the End of the World. It was like a PhD thesis, I think, like published by somebody. It turned out it was a friend of mine. Anyway, a friend of a friend of mine. But it's this book about how mushrooms grow in shit, you know, in the worst, like damp, like awful places. Then you get this life, this incredible life, that's this like network of life that's communicating all the time with all of the other life forces around it, and how much we actually have to learn about the way that nature lives, thrives, survives. The hierarchical, like top-down progress myth is actually a myth fed on murder, for murder, you know, exploitation. And that's why it feels so wrong. But actually the natural movement that we have been taught is inferior somehow, primitive, like, you know, all these disgusting, dangerous words. So, it's not too late to save the planet, but I hope that we can just get closer to it. I hope we can get closer to the planet, because that's the map right there, you know.
Oh, me too. Okay, George, I'm conscious of your sensitive of your time. Do you think we've got time for four quick fire answers?
Yeah, we've got time, man. This is good.
George, what happens next?
Well, we can only experience life 1 minute at a time. So what happens next is you move. We move. That's what happens next. We move. You know? You said quick fire answers.
That's good. I like it. I like it. Okay, nature or nurture?
I mean, I think that the environment and the surroundings of a person will have a huge impact on their ability to survive and flourish. I think that in terms of what damage can be done, it's nurture. And in terms of our ability to survive, in spite of that, it's nature. That's what I think.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. George, what matters most?
What matters most to me is service to others.
Beautiful. And finally, Kay, what is love?
So, bell hooks wrote this fantastic long essay called All About Love that I read recently. And in it, she says her working definition of love, which really I found kind of groundbreaking, is that love is, for one, it's active. It's not a feeling. It's an action that you stand behind, that you make. And love is, I'm going to paraphrase and I will get this wrong, and so I apologize. But in my reading of it, what bell hooks was saying is that love is the will to extend yourself in order for either your own or somebody else's spiritual growth. So if I love you, I'm prepared to go out on my way for your spiritual growth. And that might mean that I recognize that I'm not the right person to be around you. Do you understand what I mean? It's like that kind of working definition of love is incredible, because it means that you have to think to yourself, okay, am I prepared for this person to grow spiritually? Do I want them to be at their utmost, you know? And if it's not that, if that person doesn't want that for me, if I don't have that approach to what I'm doing with my artwork or with my family or with my loved ones, my friends, like, unless I want them to be growing and at their absolute zenith, then it's not love. And you have to accept that if it's not love, then it's braver to walk away. And also, you know, this, I read a lot of Jung, because I was writing in this last book that I published. I was talking about my relationship with Jung. And he says, where the will to power is, love is not. So love is the absence of domination, power, like, you know, within relationships, in private, intimate relationships, and also in huge social relationships, in relationships between groups of people, where there is the will to power, there is no love. So love is action. It's something that you do. It's the desire for someone's or your own spiritual growth. And it is not the will to power. There you go.
Wow. What a way to close this incredible episode. Kay, George, I feel like I've been sunbathing. and your words are like the rays of sunshine that have come down and given me the vitamin D that I needed after this long winter. That's just been absolutely mind-blowing. I need to go back and listen to that over and over and over again. You've helped me there. Like I said, I feel like I've gone back to school in this hour. And for two people that I admire so much, to hear your answer to these questions has just really, really been a gift for me and for everyone that is going to listen to this episode. So thank you so much to you both for joining me here. I sincerely hope that our paths cross sooner rather than later in a creative or social context. And much love to you both.
Bro, thank you, man.
Huge appreciation.
Likewise.
For me, that was like listening to a scripture. It was an hour of 24-carat inspiration. Kay and George are two artists who will be studied and praised by future generations for challenging the traditional social framework, for unpicking and re-sewing the fabric of popular culture, and for constantly redefining who they are, both as artists and as humans. The lessons that resonated with me as a fellow artist is that their creativity is born out of conflict, out of an internal and external struggle. That they create to question, to explore, to resolve and to heal. I'm so thankful to have had this enlightening conversation with Kay and George and to be able to share their wisdom with you all here on our podcast. If you haven't listened already, check out 12 Questions by me, Fraser T. Smith, aka Future Utopia, available on all the major streaming services. And don't forget to subscribe and like this podcast. Also, ask yourself the 12 questions, ask other people the 12 questions. I put this record out to stir debate and hopefully create change. So why don't you send us your answers to the 12 questions on Instagram and Twitter at The Future Utopia. Last but not least, a massive shout out to Becky Voice at the Tape Agency, my management crew, Phil, Kate, Jasmine and Josh at 360 for helping make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. And until then, let's make the future a utopia.